Hello and welcome to another news episode of BFRR, our Bitcoin, Fiat and Rock'n'Roll podcast that explores the intersection of traditional finance, digital assets and digital currencies and helps you understand how digital money and assets will evolve in the future. I am co-host Michael Blaschke and today it is time for another news episode, in fact, the last of 2025. So we're not only summarizing the news of the month, in particular the month's highlights, but we're also looking back on an exciting year for institutional adoption of blockchain. Today, we look back to the month of December and discuss key news in institutional blockchain. To this, I am joined by our dear guests and listeners, Ibiza and Atakan. Hi there, guys. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Mike.
Hello there.
So what will we cover today? We're closing out 2025 with the most significant institutional blockchain developments we've seen all year. Here's what's coming. First, we start with a market update. I set the stage with where we stand right now when it comes to prices and key drivers of these. Then we're going to walk you through three clusters, if you will. First, policy and infrastructure. Ibiza talks on how regulatory clarity and real-world market activity moved more and more digital assets to production across Europe and global capital markets. Then I'm gonna walk you through the world of stablecoins. I reveal how banks became stablecoin issuers also in December. Payment giants made them invisible infrastructure and dollar pegged digital currency went from crypto novelty to global commerce reality also in December. And ultimately, Atakan brings the most pivotal news in December when it comes to tokenization, TradFi integration. Atakan's going to show you which real-world assets actually made it into blockchain and why. And ultimately, a special of this very episode is a kind of a 2025 institutional blockchain wrap, as we do appreciate Ibiza's and Atakan's perspective a lot. And I want to ensure that we also understand these two guys' perspective on what this year meant, what surprised us, and what it sets up for 2026. Alrighty, let's dive in and start with the market update. Let's take a look on how the total crypto market developed over the past month until the day of recording, that is today, December 22nd, the day of recording. Yeah, the total crypto market as it stands today revitalized to a current of about $3.8 trillion. And in contrast to the $3.1 trillion at the beginning of the month, this is a positive signal at the end of the year. Among the key drivers still might be, and I emphasize the might, as it's just impossible to understand and predict which forces out there drive price behavior. But some of the key market drivers could be still the US-China trade tensions that explain some of the volatility in the market, then the de-escalation tweets. Overall, it still was a roller coaster month for crypto, showing market uncertainty and volatility everywhere. Interestingly, I observed many conversations and speculations on social about why at certain points in time there are heavy price jumps. But luckily, I often then read the comment, well, this is just natural market behavior, which is my conviction too. Yeah, looking at Bitcoin, we currently trade at $90,000. The month started at 91. The month high was 94. So there were no big surprises. I mean, at least measured against the extreme volatility of crypto, in particular in November. Now looking at Ethereum, we currently stand at around $3,000. That's also where we started the month with a high at 3,400. So again, here, not as much volatility as we experienced it the month before in November. We decided to add a bit stablecoin updates here, as it's not only been the year of stablecoins, but as we're going to cover a lot of stablecoin news today too. Interestingly, the combined USDT and USDC market cap now exceeds $260 billion. Fascinating number, isn't it? Yeah, we see banks entering a direct issuance. More about that later. And the market sentiment in general, speaking of both crypto and stablecoins, is still driven by high volatility from geopolitical uncertainty, but institutional infrastructure build continues, unsurprised by surprises. Yeah, what always for me best captures the sentiment is the fear and greed index, which sits at 29. So it's not extreme fear anymore as it was the month before, but still full of fear. So besides the price recoveries, we also see a recovery in the extent of fear in the market, which I'm glad to observe. And with that, let's dive right into the first of our themes today, that is policy, regulation, and wholesale infrastructure.
All right. So hello, everyone. Ivica speaking here. So what I have prepared for today is on which regulatory changes happened in December, so in European Union and US, and I also prepared some milestone transactions that also happened in December. So it's actually surprising to see so much activity in December, yeah, because I was thinking like everyone is shutting down slowly and going for Christmas. But yeah, a lot of things happen. And the first thing is a DLT pilot regime update that was published on December 4th. And yeah, so in general, so DLT pilot regime, it was meant as a boost for tokenization in Europe. And now European Commission has proposed earlier actually than planned a major upgrade. And it's basically addressing the critique that we had so far on, let's say, low uptake and limited activity that we had so far, the restrictive design, which makes it difficult for participants to join, and also tight volume caps, which are introducing a lot of uncertainty, and also unclear long-term commitment. Yeah? So people are not like clear if this is staying or is this only like timely limited thing. So what are the changes? So the main changes that have been introduced, first, it is to extend its scale and scope. So the scope of instruments that are supported within the pilot regime, so it has been expanded to cover all financial instruments. Of course, given the consumer protection is there. Yeah. So previously it was shares, bonds, and specific fund types. And now it's extending to derivatives, commercial papers, and beyond. So basically all financial instruments that a regulated institution would be familiar with. Then asset-specific caps have been removed, which also makes few things easier. And the total cap has been increased significantly from 6 billion to 100 billion. And the second improvement block was on flexibility and proportionality of the framework. So far, the framework is based on CSDR, and it is a pretty heavy-weighted regulation, so it's not that trivial, actually, for smaller entities or even for larger entities to join this. And what has been done now, the services that are contained in CSDR regulations, so they have been unbundled so that multiple regulated entities can pick on single functions and then to all together combined on a shared ledger that can provide the functionality for the market. But it's easier for smaller entities to join. And so the first thing is, it's easier for small businesses to go in under simplified regime. Yeah. So if you're servicing up to 10 billion in aggregated market value, then you are regulated under a simplified regime. Yeah. And the obligations that you have are proportional to your risk and size. And so this allows to grow with the business that you have. So instead of going like 100% covering all compliance requirements, so you can kind of get better and better and incrementally improve as your risk profile increases. So this is very beneficial for smaller entities.
Very similar to what we saw with Mika, right? And then the stablecoin issuers. You have significant stablecoin issuers. You have then other requirements that they have to uphold to, then maybe smaller issuers. And I think that's a very smart move on their end.
Exactly. And this is from my perspective, exactly the right approach. To apply more the proportionality principle. So how it will be in practice, we will see, yeah? Because sometimes you still have to do, let's say, a lot of heavy work before you can even think to start, but it's definitely the good way to go.
Probably to underscore why this very news made it into the top position of our set of news, so why this matters, in my opinion, is Europe's fragmentation problem.
Exactly.
Just to underscore the why here. So the European capital markets are massively fragmented. There are, I think, 300 plus exchanges, versus a rather consolidated US markets. Our European stock market cap is only 73% of the GDP. In comparison, in the US, you have 270%. In UK, you have 130%. Yeah, and investment funds here are five times smaller than US equivalents. So it's kind of, for me, that move that came earlier as expected, which is a nice signal in itself. This move is a political imperative, part of broader savings and investments union to create a single European financial market.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, I mean, there's no room anymore for local debt. Yeah. So the consolidation is really necessary. So it's a political imperative, as I said. And I'm happy that we are moving in the right direction. And so continuing with the list of the upgrades. So the list is pretty long. And as I said, so it is December and the package is not that small. But what's also interesting, certain CSD services, they have been unbundled, and so they can be distributed now across multiple regulated entities that cooperate on a shared ledger to provide the full service. Yeah. And on the other hand, it's also very interesting for CSDs themselves, because so far they always had to run everything on their own, and now they can also expand to shared infrastructures that are provided by the blockchain. So it is kind of working in both directions, so which is a good thing. Then there is also a new, I'm not really sure so how it is meant, but a new settlement scheme that DLT account keepers with access to central bank money can introduce to introduce settlements. So I think there will be very interesting things happening with this. Yeah, so definitely something to follow. But currently, I'm not sure what are the full implications of it. Yeah, it's I think the market is also still processing and parsing what this means. And the last thing is the time limit has been removed. So there is now certainty that this thing will not disappear. So people are much more motivated now, I think, to invest if they know that these licenses are going to stay. So this DLT pilot regime upgrade, so it has been published in a much larger package of savings and investments union, yeah, which has the goal to consolidate financial markets in Europe. And there are three other, let's say, aspects that I want to mention here, which are not directly related to DLT, but also important. Yeah. So the supervision is going to be centralized for, let's say, specific trading venues, CCPs, CSDs, and CASPs, yeah, under ESMA. So that's an interesting thing. So consolidating at the European level. And then directives in German Richtlinien, so they will be converted to regulations, which lowers the compliance costs for players if they want to operate Europe-wide, and which also, let's say, prevents gold plating and protectionism at a national level, yeah, which is definitely beneficial for consolidation at the European level. Yeah.
What I really find nice here, what I find so interesting here is how well institutional DLT fits into this broader SIU context, that is Savings and Investments Union. So there is a consolidated supervision, that is ESMA takes direct authority over certain trading venues like CCPs, CSDs, crypto service provider, CSPs, and with a move from directives to regulations, you're converting national directives to EU-wide regulations that lowers the compliance costs, that gives stronger legal certainty, that prevents national gold plating and protectionism. So on the one hand, we have the Savings and Investments Union, and DLT just so perfectly fits here as the facilitating technology to achieve exactly that union, right?
The good news is European Commission and European Union, they see in DLT the new operating system of financial markets. Yeah? And it comes, of course, very handy because it's solving this problem with fragmentation. It allows people to meet on a shared platform. So, yeah, and the last upgrade that I wanted to mention, so there is also a new role introduced, which is called Pan-European Market Operator, which helps to operate cross-border without having to go to every, let's say, local national regulation and obtain a license. So this will also boost the consolidation in the market.
Probably to explain this more in detail, so this Pan-European Market Operator or PMO concept drives the idea that a single EU license for cross-border operations suffices, versus currently you need a patchwork of national licenses.
Absolutely. So then it continues in Europe with ECB President Christine Lagarde, let's say, urging political institutions to act swiftly in, say, bringing the necessary laws through so that the digital euro can go to the next phase. Yeah. And yeah, the next phase that is coming is to go to the pilot phase in 2027 and call for expression of interest. So it will start in 2026, so next year. The issuance is still being expected in 2029. So a lot of people are still kind of unsure what digital euro will bring in. Yeah. And yeah, the interesting thing is there is a lot of resistance in the parliament. So basically, the proposal has been made in June 2023, but not much happened in between. And also the success of, let's say, the whole initiative depends on cooperation of, let's say, specific entities like banks, but not all of them are aligned with the agenda. Yeah. So I think there is a lot of work open there to kind of align the stakeholders. Yeah. And what I definitely can recommend here, eventually it's confirmation bias because it aligns with how I see the thing, is the Bitcoin Fiat Rock and Roll episode with Jonas and Bofinger, which was recorded a year ago. So this was very, let's say, a differentiated view on pros and cons of digital euro.
Yeah, you find the episode in the show notes. Thanks for this recommendation, Ivica.
And maybe just one comment, Ivica, before we move on. Quite interesting, because if I remember correctly, I think they were proposing that the pilot of the digital euro would be coming by 2027, if I'm not mistaken, by end of 2027. And now hearing what you've just said, it's going to be interesting to see whether they can actually uphold with that timeline. I'm a bit skeptical, as you are, I think, but I'm very excited to see what they have in store.
There will be no concrete issuance date as long as laws do not pass. So that's currently the roadblock at the moment.
My two cents on the digital euro implementation are that it suffers from a positioning problem. It's marketed as an answer to stablecoins, that is a competitive framing. The actual problem is that there is a missing pan-European card schema for cross-border payments, and that causes a false dilemma. We are framing a retail CBDC as stablecoin alternative, and that misses the point. Yeah, stablecoins are solving payment friction now, and the digital euro solves political or sovereignty concerns. So there are actually different use cases being conflated.
Absolutely, absolutely. So sometimes these discussions, they seem to be caught in a wrong dilemma, so to say. Yeah. And of course, we have problems that need to be solved. And a typical example is pan-European card scheme for cross-border payments. I myself was also surprised as I found out that when I pay something in France, it's not like European solution in the background. Running, yeah, but there are already like initiatives in this regard. And of course, there is now, it's a kind of a balancing act. What do I do? So do I introduce something new or do I support existing things to cover these?
I think Vero is trying to solve that, right? But Vero also has issues when it comes to at least point of sale payments, because it's based on tips. And you have I think, settlement throughput of 10 seconds. In total, and I just can't imagine the user experience having to wait 10 seconds and potentially even something fails. So quite interesting dilemma that potentially other digital forms of money could solve.
It's absolutely.
The bottom line for me regarding the ECB or the digital money is that the ECB is racing to launch a digital euro by 2026 to counter stablecoin adoption, but actually faces a coordination problem. Parliaments haven't legislated, banks lack incentives to actually implement it, and the core pitch addresses sovereignty concerns in Europe rather than the actual payment friction that drives users to stablecoins now already, meaning even if the digital euro was were to be launched on schedule, adoption would remain the biggest challenge than technology itself.
All right. So now moving from Europe to US regulations. So what's interesting there, I mean, of course, we all know for Genius and Clarity Act. Yeah. So let's say no swimming sign has been removed, as somebody smart said. Yeah. And now participants, market participants and regulators are trying to figure out how to swim. Indeed. And one thing in this regard is that the Fed reverses the policy from 2023, which restricted banks from crypto activities. And now they are allowing case-by-case, let's say, permissions for uninsured institutions. So all institutions that are under deposit insurance, they remain subject to strict limits. But uninsured banks, they can then go to Fed board and ask for a permission for business with crypto, and this will be done case by case. So as we can see here, so the regulator is loosening step-by-step rulings in regard to cryptocurrencies.
Just to underscore the shift that happened through this regulation is that actually in 2023, Fed restricted state banks from crypto activities. And now in December 2025, this policy is reserved. So these case-by-case permissions are now allowed and not by default state banks are restricted.
All right. So this was the regulation part. So now I would quickly walk through interesting transactions. I would even say milestone transactions that happened in December. So the first one was JP Morgan working as an arranger for a landmark commercial paper issuance on Solana public blockchain for Galaxy Digital. So the issue was Galaxy Digital Holdings. And the arranger was JP Morgan. So the arranger was also responsible to create the token itself. And the purchasers were Coinbase and Franklin Templeton. Yeah. And the DVP delivery versus payment was performed with USDC stablecoin by Circle, which was for me a little bit surprising, yeah, because I was expecting to read Kinexus somewhere there, or even JP Morgan coin, yeah. But this was a really interesting thing because it happened on a public blockchain, so that was the first thing, and the second thing is it was paid with stablecoins, yeah. So from the milestone perspective, so it was the first US transaction using blockchain for issuance and servicing of securities, and JP Morgan demonstrated, from my perspective, being open for public blockchains beside the corporate blockchain Kinexus. Yeah, so now the question is, so what's next? Yeah, so will we see also trades where we will have delivery versus payment with JP Morgan coin? Because it has been made available on Base, on Coinbase blockchain. And as we can see here, Clarity Act is definitely helping to remove obstacles in the market. Yeah, and we see now first pilots that try to figure out how to scale this on-chain.
Yeah, this JP Morgan Solana deal is, for me, strategically brilliant theater, proving institutional willingness to use public blockchains and validating the post-Clarity regulatory framework. But the hard questions begin now, actually. So whether on-chain securities infrastructure scales beyond pilots, and this depends on demonstrating risk-adjusted efficiency gains over existing digital rails, not just technical feasibility that has been tested so far. So we actually passed the question, can blockchain work for securities? And now entering the question, does it work better enough to justify operational complexity at a $1 trillion scale? And the answer to this question determines if this becomes a footnote in the history of finance or really an inflection point in how we run our financial system.
Very well put, yeah.
Good, yeah. Today, we are also diving deeply into what might be a significant month for stablecoins and institutional crypto history, if you will. December 2025 is the moment when dollar-pegged digital currencies decisively crossed the threshold from a crypto novelty to really mainstream financial infrastructure, I think. We're seeing banks issue their own stablecoins, payment giants integrate them into everyday commerce, and regulators worldwide racing to establish frameworks. So this convergence is really reshaping how money moves globally. This is great. Yeah. So let's establish where we are. The stablecoin market has evolved dramatically since the turbulent days back then in March 2023 when Silicon Valley Bank's collapse triggered USDC's DPEG and exposed critical vulnerabilities in how these instruments interact with traditional banking. That crisis was a watershed moment, wasn't it? It demonstrated both the fragility of stablecoins dependent on bank deposits and the systemic importance they'd quietly achieved. Yeah. And now fast forward to December 2025, and the landscape is really different. We now have regulatory clarity in the United States through the Genius Act, which was signed in July, actually one day before my birthday. That's why I remember so well. The European Union's MiCA framework is operational. Tether and Circle's combined market capitalization exceeds $260 billion. But more importantly, the conversation has shifted from if to how, so from existential debates about the legitimacy to practical implementation questions about infrastructure, custody, and interoperability. This transformation is reflected in who's building. Traditional financial institutions aren't watching from the sidelines anymore. They are issuing, they're integrating, they're competing. This is kind of the stage we find ourselves on when looking at the news in December of 2025. And the first theme on this stage is really that banks continue to enter the arena. The most striking development in December for me was banks becoming direct stablecoin issuers ever more. SoFi Technologies just became the first nationally chartered FDIC-insured bank in the United States to launch its own stablecoin, referred to as SoFi USD. This isn't a pilot program or proof of concept, of which we saw so many. It's really a production-ready, digital dollar-backed, one-to-one by cash reserves held at the Federal Reserve itself, which is really interesting. So think about what that represents. For years, stablecoin skeptics argued these instruments couldn't be trusted because they operated outside regulated banking. Now we have a regulated bank issuing a stablecoin precisely because it sees strategic value in doing so.
Yeah, and I think that's the first step, right? The issuance. Now it's going to be interesting how the stablecoin, for instance, is going to be adopted. I think we've covered it in last month's episode as well. There's a lot of institutions now issuing, but it's going to be interesting to see the interactions between different coins. Or will it remain as we have it today, where Tether and Circle are basically the non-plus-ultra issuers?
Yeah, and across the Atlantic in Europe, here with us, we're seeing coordinated action too. BNP Paribas joined 9 other European banks in a consortium called Quivalis, preparing to launch a MiCA compliant euro stablecoin in the second half of 2026. We have a prominent standalone episode with one of the contributors of that consortium. The news is that BNP Paribas joins the consortium. So this consortium includes ING, UniCredit, Deutsche Bank's DK Bank, and others spanning the Netherlands, Italy, Belgium, Denmark, Germany, Sweden, Spain, and Austria. So their newly appointed CEO, Jan-Oliver Sell, comes directly from Coinbase Germany, really signaling serious intent to make this stablecoin a success. And what's particularly interesting is their stated philosophy. Floris Luck from ING explained it clearly, quote unquote, "European customers don't want to deal with dozens of different euro stablecoins. They want one trusted standard." So end of quote. So this is banks thinking like infrastructure providers, not competitors. They are building a common utility rather than 9 or 10 competing stablecoin instruments.
I think this is an important aspect, yeah, because people are now starting to realize that they need to cooperate on the infrastructure, and then they can still compete on, let's say, the application layer and the product services on top. But this basic infrastructure, like having the network, having payment means and so on, so it is beneficial for everyone if people cooperate.
Yes, and then a second theme when it comes to stablecoins is that payment giants integrate deeply. So While banks are issuing, as I just outlined with the two prominent examples across both sides of the Atlantic, payment companies are integrating stablecoins into existing flows at remarkable speed and scale. The standout here is the breadth of integration across different use cases. PayPal's PYUSD stablecoin is now financing artificial intelligence infrastructure through a partnership with USD.AI. Starting in January 2026, then, they're offering a 4.5% yield on deposits up to $1 billion for a year. This isn't traditional finance lending to crypto. This is a major fintech using its own digital currency to fund computational infrastructure for AI development. And the capital flows are blockchain native, but the purpose is decidedly real world. And more striking for mainstream adoption, YouTube now allows creators in the United States to receive their platform payouts in PYUSD. This matters because YouTube creators represent a significant gig economy workforce. PayPal's head of crypto confirmed the feature's live, and creators can now choose to be paid in stablecoin rather than waiting for traditional bank transfers, which take their time, as all of us know. And Google doesn't have to build any crypto infrastructure themselves. PayPal abstracts all that complexity away. Intuit went even further in this regard. Their partnership with Circle integrates USDC across TurboTax, QuickBooks, and Credit Karma. Think about those touch points. TurboTax handles tax refunds, potentially the largest single payment many people receive annually, with over $100 billion in annual volume in the United States alone. QuickBooks powers millions of small businesses. The integration here is about embedding stablecoins into financial moments that already happen, making them invisible infrastructure rather than a separate crypto experience. And then Visa's moves are particularly revealing. They launched a dedicated stablecoins advisory practice with dozens of clients, including Navy Federal Credit Union and VStar. More concretely, they are now settling transactions in USDC directly in the United States. They've passed $3.5 billion in annualized stablecoin settlement volume. Cross River Bank and Lead Bank are already settling with Visa and USDC over the Solana blockchain. Visa is also becoming a design partner for Circle's new Arc blockchain and will operate a validator node once it launches. So here, there is no experimentation. Visa is rebuilding settlement infrastructure around stablecoins, offering 7-day settlement windows instead of traditional 5 business day cycles. For financial institutions, this means better liquidity management and automated treasury operations. Yeah, and a third theme that I found really interesting is around global commerce and emerging markets. So the real world utility is most visible in global commerce and emerging markets, where traditional banking infrastructure often is simply expensive, slow, and or even simply absent. Bridge, recently acquired by Stripe for $1.1 billion, is powering global card programs that let users spend stablecoin balances directly at millions of merchants worldwide. Then Zaps, the company behind Sandwave and WorldRemit, serving 9 million customers, is launching a bridge-powered card in Brazil and another market in early 2026, and their customers can already send, store, and spend USDC across 100 countries through the Sandwave wallet. So the card extends this to everyday purchases. Yeah, and even Alibaba is building a tokenized global payment network using JP Morgan's technology. It's targeting launch by end of the year for its $35 billion B2B commerce ecosystem. Yeah, this is tokenized fiat, essentially a stablecoin model designed to make cross-border trade settlement feel instantaneous. Yeah, so much about the fascinating developments around stablecoins in the institutional world. And there also happened interesting things around tokenization and the integration of traditional finance.
Yes, most definitely, Michael. I think before I start starting with the news, let me take a step back. And if you look visually at the spectrum of financial market players, on one hand side, you have the traditional players, the JP Morgans of the world. On the other side, you may have crypto native firms. And I think what we've seen this December is specifically both sides narrowing down to each other. Let me start with some crypto exchanges. So Coinbase, with their recent system update, has announced a broad set of new products. Amongst them, they have AI-powered investing tools. They are now introducing prediction markets. But I think what's specifically interesting is they are now offering stock trading to their customers. So from today onwards, US customers can buy and sell traditional stocks using the Coinbase app. Settlement will be on USD or USDC. So they are also introducing the possibility to pay with stablecoins. However, the entire stock trading will mostly run on traditional rails. But in their announcement, in their press release, they already teased that they believe everything will be tokenized in the future. And hence, they are also announcing that early next year, they're planning to tokenize stocks and public equities and make them available in the Coinbase app and thus enable 24/7 trading and essentially make public equity or turn public equity into bearer instruments that can be used as collateral, be entirely on chain, and then plugged into DeFi-like workflows. Interestingly, competitor Kraken follows up with a similar move. Kraken has acquired Bakkt. Bakkt is the company behind XStox. For those that are unaware of XStox, XStox is essentially a one-to-one wrapper for US equities. So somewhere in the world, there is a real stock that exists and is custodied by a regulated entity. And XStox is essentially creating a token and wrapping this stock and creating a bearer token, and similar to what Coinbase plans. However, in this case, Kraken allows this today, so users can buy, sell, and trade tokenized stocks on centralized exchanges such as Kraken, but also use it for self-custody and potentially use them in DeFi protocols in the future as collateral. Maybe to add an angle here, because as we mentioned earlier, issuance is the first step, but it's the next step is then distribution. And I think what's interesting is that XStox is now available in the Tron wallet. So Telegram's users globally, and they have excluded the US, Europe, and Australia, I'm guessing because of regulatory requirements. But people besides those countries are now able to basically access tokenized US stocks with just one Telegram account, which is very, very interesting. With that, in a similar direction goes Forward Industries. It's a 60-year-old company. I had to look this up. And they were focusing on product design initially, but have pivoted away and shifted into being one of the largest Solana asset treasuries. And Forward Industries, as a public company, it's tokenizing their entire public equity on Solana. This makes Forward Industries the very first SEC-registered public company that is now natively issuing their shares on-chain. So this is not a synthetic exposure or any tokenized wrapped form of public equity, but rather natively tokenized securities. And what's the next step? Well, these tokenized shares can already or are already integrated into Kamino, Solana's leading lending protocol, which means that these stocks can be used as collateral in DeFi. This is not a pilot. This is not a demo. This is actually in production. People can use it for borrowing stablecoins and other interesting deals. Let me then move away from the crypto native firms, maybe towards traditional players. We've seen two quite interesting moves, one from JP Morgan. So JP Morgan is launching its first tokenized market money fund, and it will be issued on Ethereum and will be distributed via their Kinexys digital assets platform, and is essentially targeted at qualified investors. In a similar move, looking at Europe, also Amundi, so Europe's second largest asset manager, is also issuing a money market fund, a tokenized money market fund, also on Ethereum, and they are using Caseus as their infrastructure provider. So we are seeing not only the crypto native firms moving into traditional finance and traditional financial instruments, but we are also seeing the traditional players now adopting tokenization technology and issuing on public permissionless infrastructure such as Ethereum.
So tokenized money market funds like Amundi and JP Morgan deliver tokenization without changing risk profiles, isn't it? So institutional cash-like infrastructure offering faster settlement, intraday liquidity and programmable treasury flows while maintaining capital preservation and regulatory stability that defines money market funds. And then there are tokenized equities, those of Coinbase tokenize, backed Kraken. They introduce composability with equity volatility, so bearer assets that behave like stable coins in transferability, but carry stock risk or yield, creating DeFi collateral use cases that fundamentally alter how securities are borrowed against and traded. And there's a contrast between those tokenized money market funds and tokenized equities. So the money market funds prove blockchain can optimize existing institutional workflows. So for example, settlement efficiency without disrupting asset fundamentals. Equities or tokenized equities, in turn, in my understanding, prove that blockchain can transform the behavior of an asset through programmability and peer-to-peer transfer in ways that may challenge securities law assumptions about custody, settlement, investor protection. Yeah, so I hope you agree with me how those two tokenized assets contrast strategically.
Definitely. I mean, it basically gives you the opportunity to have the most liquid and more, or how can I best put it? It increases the velocity of financial interactions by miles. And I'm very excited to see the adoption of this, but that's then up for next year, and to see the efficiency gains that we all promise ourselves by the technology actually put into place.
All right. Ivica Atakan, it's not only an interesting month. Looking back at December and really all of 2025, I think we can say this was the year institutional blockchain really moved from, let's call it an interesting experiment, to already some critical infrastructure. And I mean that quite literally. Let me walk you through what I've seen this year as super interesting developments. And first and foremost, of course, 2025 was a stablecoin inflection point. The biggest story for 2025 is clearly stablecoins for me. We're not talking about crypto native companies operating in the wild, wild west anymore. We are talking about Sony launching a stablecoin for PlayStation payments this month. SoFi, a publicly traded bank, issuing the first bank native stablecoin backed by Fed reserves, and JP Morgan tokenizing money market funds on Ethereum, a public blockchain. Who would have thought that 5 years ago that a bank would expose itself on a public ledger? So this isn't the future anymore. This is happening right now. And here's what's really fascinating to me. The stablecoin wars, if you want to overstretch the term, have gone global and institutional. You've got 10 major European banks, as explained, including BNP Paribas, ING, UniCredit, forming a consortium for a European stablecoin. You've got Sony partnering with Bastion. You've got PayPal expanding PYUSD into AI infrastructure financing. You've got Visa launching an entire advisory practice dedicated to stablecoins. So what does this tell us? Stablecoins have become the bridge between traditional finance and blockchain. They are no longer a crypto curiosity. They are just becoming essentially payment rails. And when YouTube now even starts paying creators in PYUSD, and when Visa settles over $3.5 billion annually in USDC, when companies use stablecoins to automate cross-border payments, then that's the definition of mainstream adoption in my definition. And that's why stablecoins experience their inflection point in 2025.
I can only agree. And what a better time to work at a stablecoin company than now, than this year.
Yeah, good choice, Atakan. And that even in a product role, yeah, I envy you.
It feels like exactly. Every year an afterburner is being fired, so to say. Yeah. And things are speeding more and more up. Yeah, not linearly, but like exponentially. And this is really good.
That is true.
To be in this industry, I would say.
But I think what's also important is, as I've already hinted previously, but the issuance is the very first step. And we're still in the beginning, and it's great to see adoption starting and access being broadened globally. But I think the next step is basically putting it into practice and actually gaining and increasing trading volume. And in order for that to happen, and maybe I'm taking some things now from my basically lessons learned of this year, is that the money and payments are the very first beginning. It's the set stone, and what follows next are the assets. And now that we're seeing assets being tokenized on chain, I think it's going to be very interesting to see what follows up with all the stablecoin initiatives that have been started. I think we won't have about 90 different stablecoins being actively used. I think it's going to be just a few, but time will tell.
Imagine your heater not only keeping you warm, but also earning you Bitcoin at the same time. That's exactly what the Ofen 2 by 21 Energy does. This isn't science fiction, it's Austrian engineering. The Ofen 2 is essentially a Bitcoin mining heater. It converts 1,000 watts of electricity into 100% heat, heats rooms of up to 50 square meters, and while it heats, it uses the energy twice. It mines Bitcoin for you. And the best part? True plug and play. You don't need any technical knowledge at all. Just plug it in, connect it to the 21 Energy app via Wi-Fi. Done in 3 minutes. It's whisper quiet and looks absolutely stunning. Premium steel design, made in Austria. Instead of just consuming energy, you get cash back in Bitcoin. Use your energy twice. Get the Ofen 2 at 21energy.com.
I mean, if we think about what's happening right now, we are basically overhauling the whole financial market infrastructure. So, and this is like something which takes decades. Yeah, one decade we spent on showing that it goes from zero to one. And I think this phase is over now, and now we are kind of all over the verge, and we are at the beginning of showing that it goes from one to many, yeah? So which basically means scaling. Yeah. And then, of course, a lot of different aspects need to be covered. Yeah? So infrastructure, regulation, then how do assets come to life? Yeah? So assets of different kind, how their life cycle is managed, how payments are working, how trading works. And what we can more and more see, and the picture is getting like clear, is that in all different categories that need to kind of be brought to a specific level, yeah, things are happening and things are in motion. Yeah. So, which is nice thing to observe. Yeah. And the clarity that it will come, so to say, to scaling, it's getting more and more concrete. Yeah. It's not like it could be or whatever. Yeah. So it is like on the way. So that can be clearly said.
Yeah. And what plugs into that, and what is another conclusion for me for 2025, is that regulatory clarity is finally emerging. So my second major theme for 2025 is regulatory maturation. For years, we've heard in all these panels the statement, we need clear rules. Well, 2025 delivered. The US Senate is moving forward with the Clarity Act. The SEC released actual guidance on crypto custody and trading platforms. The Fed reversed its restrictive 2023 policy, as you outlined, Ivica. And Circle and Ripple got preliminary approval for national trust bank charters. This is huge because for the first time, institutions aren't operating in a gray zone. They have frameworks, they have pathways to compliance, they have regulatory certainty, or at least the beginning of it. And it's Not just the US, the ECB is pushing hard for the digital euro launch in late 2026. MiCAR in Europe has been live for a year now, and Germany alone issued more licenses than we saw in most jurisdictions historically. The UAE gave Ripple's RLUSD regulatory approval. Even China, despite reaffirming its crypto ban, is clearly thinking about controlled frameworks for digital currencies. So 25 brought regulatory clarity to the forefront.
And what of course helps, I would say definitely helps, that there is a healthy competition between US and Europe now. And what also helps is this idea of European sovereignty. So it's also a strong driving force, yes, because we need to consolidate if we want to stay sovereign, I would say. Yeah. And this is a good driver, I would say.
So Atakan, what is your conclusion of institutional blockchain in 2025?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm going to repeat some of the things you've mentioned, Michael. But for me, yes, this year is the year of stablecoins. I also see it as a year of plumbing. As I mentioned earlier, money and payments are the groundstone, the fundament, basically. So without money and payments, you can't do financial transactions or do financial activity. But I think the next step is going to be putting traditional financial assets onto blockchains. And I think this is what we've seen in specifically the past few months, so towards the end of 2025. So seeing public companies shoot up 4% on the stock market because they're talking about stablecoins or announcing a stablecoin project, I think just shows how relevant stablecoins have become in this year. But again, I'm looking forward and see that there's much more than just issuance. There's a whole ecosystem that you need to build. And it's going to be interesting to see what companies and what ecosystems will strive next year. Maybe just one last topic that is also quite filling of mine for this year is the topic of infrastructure. I think looking back into the beginning of this year, we still had some discussions about, is public permissionless infrastructure a viable option? Should it be private permissioned infrastructure? And just looking at the vast majority of all these news pieces that we've covered today, I can optimistically say the public infrastructure just wins. I mean, it provides you so many value adds, such as 24/7 availability, you have network effects, you have neutrality, and you already have such a strong developer ecosystem that I think it's quite a clear case now for public infrastructure.
No, there is a point where I need to object slightly. So where I definitely agree is permissionless blockchains. Of course, it's like innovation jungle, and they're open, they're neutral, yeah, and it helps to drive innovation. Yeah. But looking now on scaling, let's say, financial market cases, then you also need to think about, let's say, having something which is compliance optimized. Yeah? And so for this reason, I think it's always like trade-off constellations. So there will be use cases which work well with permissionless blockchains, but also there are use cases that need permission blockchains. And I mean, the news went in direction that permissionless blockchains are kind of winning, but there were also news that we skipped. Where larger players that also want to scale went for permissioned blockchains like Canton in US. And in Europe, we, of course, have good initiatives like regulated layer one in this regard. I think it's a mix. It's a mix because it's a trade-off constellation, and there is no trade-off constellation which is perfect in all aspects. What I also wanted to add, because we cannot end this episode without mentioning Pontes and Appian in wholesale CBDC. We talked a lot about stablecoins, and they are over the verge already. So a lot of things have been issued, and we are in search for scaling the use cases. But on a wholesale CBDC side, there is also a lot of things happening. Pontes is going to production next year, and they are not targeting interoperability mechanism to connect with DLTs, but they're also looking to solve transaction finality of wholesale CBDC in a token form on DLT, which is, of course, an important aspect to be solved for Appian. Yeah. And they have also introduced something which is called Eurosystem DLT. So it will be very interesting to see what's happening there, yeah, if they will be open this also for the asset side, so everything can be combined on the same ledger.
Excellent. Thank you so much for bringing your conclusions on institutional blockchain in 2025. A fascinating year. I learned a lot personally, professionally about that space. Certainly, traditionally, let's close the news episode with some compelling knowledge bites, that is, pieces that you found relevant and useful. Atakan, what can you recommend to us and our listeners to further educate themselves?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Michael. I've brought along a project that, or paper that I followed very closely from the get-go. It's BIS project Rialto. They have recently published the technical report on their experimentation. And essentially what Project Rialto resembles is they're focusing on low amount peer-to-peer cross-border payments. And interestingly, they're building this project or technical experimentation on two previous BIS projects, namely Nexus and Project Mariana. So they have built, or they have leveraged national and domestic instant payment systems for certain instant payments, but also for messaging across borders using ISO 222 messaging standards, and have then leveraged wholesale CBDCs to settle the FX using an AMM in the Ethereum testnet. So quite interesting to see what they're doing. I think central bankers are not sleeping. They are also very much looking at the innovation we've seen in the past few years and are also posing interesting concepts on how we could, in the future, pay cross borders.
Thank you, Atakan. What I brought is an IMF paper called Understanding Stablecoins. It's a pretty large document. The paper provides a comprehensive overview of stablecoins. It discusses market developments, use cases, potential benefits, associated risks, and the evolving international regulatory landscape on stablecoins. So now that we understand that 2025 was the year of stablecoins, for those of you who want to catch up on the concept and the status of its materialization in the industry, actually, do read that document. I really enjoyed it. How about Ivica?
So what I brought is the $1 trillion battle for money's operating system from Christian Catalini. So there is, let's say, widely known and especially as one of the co-creators of Diem, formerly Libra. And yeah, the article is basically about how large corporations like Circle and MasterCard are battling for the platform dominance in payments. Yeah, and Catalini calls these corporate chains, like, for instance, Arc by Circle. And the conclusion of the article is that these corp chains or proprietary systems, they might be faster in the start, but in the long term, such system lose in a moment when the need to experiment at the edge outgrows platform operators' capacity to prove these experiments. So because if you have a gatekeeper, then this gatekeeper simply does not have the capacity to approve the innovation that is would be necessary or would be possible on this platform. And I like this very much because it most probably, again, due to confirmation bias, so it matches pretty well like how we see that financial industry should leverage DLT on scale. So it should decouple the product or the financial service from the platform and make the platform like the shared good, the commodity, the utility, and then compete on top of it. And as I objected to public permissionless blockchain, but public permissionless blockchains are the best example how this, let's say, competition takes place. And now what we think that we need for the financial industry is to bring this idea into the regulated environment by making this compliance optimized, but in a way not strangling, let's say, these positive properties like openness and neutrality and utility properties. So that's what I brought.
Yeah, thank you, Ivica and Atakan, for bringing your knowledge bites too. As this is the last episode of 2025, let's close the episode with some thank yous. Thank you all for a great 2025, our first year in English. Welcome also to all the new listeners around the globe who joined us this year. Thanks for listening to BFRR throughout 2025. Thanks to the co-hosts and the excellent guests like Ivica and Atakan for your takes and insights. Thanks for being part of our B4R community, predominantly the Ample Conversations on Telegram and LinkedIn. Let's really close the episode, but also the year, with some calls to action. Let's get started together in 2026 and improve education about digital assets and digital money. If you enjoy the podcast, please recommend and rate us. That helps us the most. Do connect with us on YouTube, LinkedIn, and our expert communities in both German and English on Telegram. You find the access to those communities in the show notes. Visit our website for more detailed analysis and detailed show notes. And make sure to subscribe to Bitcoin, Fiat, and Rock'n'Roll wherever you get your podcasts, and join us next week in January, when we'll be exploring another critical development in the evolution of digital finance. Until then, this is Bitcoin, Fiat, and Rock'n'Roll, bringing Europe's perspective on digital currencies and digital assets to the world. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Thank you for the invitation. Bye.
The views expressed are solely the personal opinions of the hosts and are provided for informational purposes only. This podcast does not offer financial or investment advice. Always conduct your own research and make well-informed decisions before investing. Please be aware that the hosts and guests may hold cryptocurrencies or digital assets discussed in this episode.